Welcome to Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin
on BreadboxMedia.com.
Today we're going to consider Catholics in colonial America. By that I mean British colonial America. Anti-Catholicism has been called America's oldest and most abiding prejudice. In early New England, it went unquestioned. Even the laws against celebrating Christmas were imported from England into the New England colonies. All this was rooted in the theological narrowness then dominant in the Western world, perhaps more powerfully in the history of the mother country, England. From Elizabeth to George III, stringent no-popery laws had been passed in Britain and in Ireland, not only to counter the feeble efforts of the remaining Catholic nobility to restore the Catholic faith, but to eradicate what remained of the old loyalty to the Roman Catholic Church and to Rome among Englishmen. England remains today a theocracy. The head of state is the head of church. So to be Catholic and to have allegiance to an international office, the head of your religion, is to have a greater allegiance than that to your state. So many people viewed Catholics as traitors from the outset. So as a result, Roman Catholics were for centuries the victims of persecution and even religious cleansing in Ireland. So the spirit of these anti-Catholic laws in Ireland called the penal laws, where one could go to jail or get hung for going to mass, by and large were enthusiastically exported to the New World. The colonists shared John Cotton's view that it was toleration that made the world anti-Christian. Anti-Catholic feelings among the colonists were also tied into the popular hatred then felt by Englishmen for their threatening enemies, France and Spain. Because of their strong ties with the papacy, both of these nations were identified with the Church of Rome, as were their settlements on the New Continent, New France, and the outposts of Spain in the far west part of North America. These colonies were established through the efforts not only of explorers, but of Jesuit and Franciscan missionaries, and in Florida and in Mexico. Among the priests of the two orders, Louis Hennepin and Jacques Marquette, explorers of the Middle West, and Hunepin Osata, soon to be canonized, who established the California missions and laid out the map for what is now California. The stories of just a few of these men have found their way into the American schoolbooks, but most others of the great men and women who did their evangelical and missionary duties and gave their lives to it, lived and died in obscurity. And after their death, they remain unknown except to historical specialists, not having made it into the standard history books. Most popular historical accounts usually begin the colonization of America with the arrival of British in Jamestown, 1623, a good 100 years after Spanish Catholics established towns and colonies, and 600 years after the Viking Catholic colonies in Greenland, where there were 14 parishes in the year 1000, in the 11th century. But as to New France and the Spanish outposts in the West, the American outposts of continental Catholicism would later be incorporated into the Union, but to the men of the 13 colonies they seemed as foreign as the European powers that ruled over them. At a time when the heirs of the Puritans were still determined to establish a novus ordo seculorum on American soil.
A new order of the ages on American soil.
Everything reminiscent of the age of despotic popes and lordly Roman prelates represented not only a theological abomination, but a danger to the state's internal security. The promise of the
new order of the ages, the novus ordo seculorum, is on your dollar bill right in your pocket.
Even the powerlessness and practical invisibility of the first American Catholic did not diminish their fears. Even though the first American Catholics supported the revolution, at least in the same proportion as other colonists. How many Catholics served in the Continental Army is not known, but we do have John Carroll's word that their blood flowed as freely in proportion to their number, to cement the fabric of independence as that of their fellow citizens. When the nation began, Roman Catholics in the United States accounted for less than 40,000 in a population of 4 million, like 1%.
The percentage for Catholics earlier was far higher, even among the Indians, but a ruthless British persecution of Catholics had occurred.
It was a major element in the French and Indian Wars. In some places, there had been religious cleansing of Catholic colonies of Spain and France by the British. The city of St. Augustine in Florida, just a few miles outside the borders of the original 13 colonies, was burned to the ground 5 times by the British, motivated by an anti-Catholic prejudice. Sir Francis Drake burned it the first time and was greatly praised by Queen Elizabeth for doing so. Most of the original British colonies forbade Catholicism. This was the case in the colony of Georgia, whose governor, Oglethorpe, as general of Georgia's armies, sacked and burned St. Augustine the last 2 times. St. Augustine lay in an unfortunate geographic place, a Catholic colony lying just a few miles south of the border of a Protestant colony. Small wonder that there were not many Catholics in colonial America. So just an estimated 1% of the inhabitants of the original 13 colonies were Catholics. Some were the descendants of the original English settlers of Maryland. Others were found in scattered Irish and German settlements in Pennsylvania. A very large number of Irish Catholics were the slaves of the British in South Carolina and other colonies. As a matter of fact, most of the slaves imported in the 17th century were white Catholic slaves from Ireland. Isolated Catholics lived quietly and obscurely in order not to arouse the furies of anti-Catholic prejudice that bedeviled the age. There were traces of French Catholics in Kentucky and up around the Great Lakes and in Florida. If all the Catholic families who had immigrated to the colonies had kept faith with the church, their number would have been significantly larger by the time of the Revolution. But in face of the penal laws against Catholicism throughout the colonies, many had drifted away, some into religious indifference, others into Protestant churches. So what were the penal laws? Coming Soon is a Setting the Record Straight entirely devoted to the penal laws. They were quite dramatic. But briefly, these laws were based on the idea that Catholicism was not only an enemy of the true Christian religion, but a political conspiracy. A New York law drafted in 1700, for example, decreed that any priest ordained by the Pope who practiced Catholic rites shall be deemed and accounted an incendiary and disturber of the public peace and safety, and was to be banished from the colony. 4 years later, priests in Maryland were forbidden by law to baptize children. 12 years after that, the same colony imposed severe penalties on public officials who even attended a mass. Religious restrictions of this sort were commonplace in the colonies in 1774. Frequent discussions and writing about this problem and this intolerance fail to recognize its foundation. Lay not in a theological dispute, but in the royal succession, the continuation of the Tudor line on the throne of England. Henry VIII won his marriage annulled, so could marry Anne Boleyn. The Pope refused. So Henry VIII abandoned the Catholic Church and set up a separate religion, a specifically British religion under the throne. And with himself as virtually a new British Pope, he declared himself divorced and married Anne Boleyn. No person adhering to the Catholic religion could regard this as a legitimate act without denying their Catholicism. This left them in a terrible quandary because Henry VIII began a vicious persecution that began with the destruction of the monasteries and the distribution of 1/5 of England, which was owned by the Catholic Church, into the hands of his nobles who became bought-off nobles, and the persecution of those who remained in adherence to the Catholic religion began. For Henry VIII and the British crown, it was a holy war. There were many martyrs, many drawn and quartered and beheading Catholics for simple things as attending Mass. The confrontation went on for centuries. If the body count is a measure of who won the war, then Henry VIII won the war against the Catholics by killing hundreds of thousands of martyrs. I bring all this up because without understanding the vehemence of the line of British rulers from the House of Tudors, including Elizabeth, against Catholics who by their very religion could not recognize her validity as the crown head, it was a coincidence of negatives, a perfect storm against Catholics. understand that vehemence. That was conveyed full bore into the American colonies. Of course they were anti-Catholic, without really knowing why. There had been a century of disinformation against the Catholic Church. The stain of it is still with us today. Henry's illegitimate new wife gave birth to Elizabeth, an illegitimate child. Elizabeth was the next Queen of England. No Catholic who believed in the tenets of his faith could escape, could regard her as legitimate. She was an illegitimate child and an illegitimate queen. So from then on, automatically, every Catholic was a traitor to the throne, because the throne was the Church of England. They were the same thing. It was a theocracy. The Catholics were caught in a prison, victims of an accident of history. This established the foundation for attitudes in the British colonies. From this foundation began a campaign of extermination of Catholics that went on for centuries. And the illegitimacy of Henry VIII's marriage to Anne Boleyn was the nub of the problem, and the record needs to be set straight and exposed. It did not begin in a simply theological dispute. It began in a matter of the Catholic Church's position that there had been an illegitimate break in the succession of the royal crown. Catholics could never be forgiven for this. Still haven't been. We'll be back after this short break. Welcome back to a reflection on Catholics in colonial America. This is Chuck Coughlin in Setting the Record Straight. So there was powerful feeling against Catholics in the British colonies, and they were suppressed. Alexander Hamilton wrote, "There are at this time in the adjacent county not less than 5 or 6 well-meaning men in close jail for publishing their religious sentiments. I have squabbled and scolded, abused and ridiculed so long about it to little purpose that I am without common patience. And so I must beg you to pity me and pray for liberty of conscience to all." The proportion of papists among the colonists was indeed small. Though George Washington did specifically commend the Catholics who served under his command. Perhaps we do know the name of John Barry, the father of the Navy. He was Catholic, and despite this, found a place in history. At first, the Catholics in the colonies had only slight hopes that complete religious freedom would follow independence. But they certainly saw that there was nothing to look forward to in the British rule. Under British rule, they had experienced the anti-Catholic persecutions of an Anglican theocracy. This was temporarily interrupted for a long period by a Puritan theocracy, which proved to be much worse. This fact and the additional circumstance that Catholic France supported the revolt had, by the end of the Revolutionary War, improved what would now be called the Catholic's public image. Although the British prejudice had certainly been transported to the New World, there was a softening of the attitude during the Revolution against the British. George Washington, when he was new to the presidency, said, "I presume that your fellow citizens will not forget the patriotic part which you took in the accomplishment of their revolution and the establishment of their government, or the important assistance which we have received from the nation of France, in which the Roman Catholic religion is professed." Earlier, as general of the army, Washington had outlawed, quote, "the ridiculous and childish custom of burning the effigy of the Pope during the celebration of Guy Fawkes Day." Even today, in some parts of England, the effigy of the Pope is burned on Guy Fawkes Day. Despite Washington's friendly gestures, anti-Catholicism was too deeply rooted in the colonies to be easily dispelled. Basically, the British fear was that the Tudor line of Henry VIII would be broken if he did not have a son. Therefore, he sought a divorce.
when the divorce or annulment was denied by the Pope, he broke off and formed his own church. Now, John Calvin and Martin Luther certainly had a well-thought-out and carefully articulated theological dispute with the Catholic Church that inspired their Protestant revolt. But the rationale that lay behind the English Protestant Reformation was to devise a means by which the Tudor succession could hold on to the throne through succeeding generations. Compared to the others, this was a slim rationale. It meant that the suppression of Catholicism became a face-saving necessity. This was no time for theological arguments. Now, the recurrent fear that Catholicism would gain a foothold did not arise out of thin air. It was based on the fact that the Church had developed its own political theories and its own notions of church-state relationships in the pre-democratic past, and clung to them tenaciously, while the world beyond its reach was changing radically. This remained the source of religious tensions in the United States right up to the presidency of John F. Kennedy. And John F. Kennedy only was elected to the presidency after virtually renouncing his allegiance to the Catholic Church. In a speech at a Baptist college in Texas, when he stated that he would not take his Catholicism with him into the Oval Office. At that point, for example, the state of West Virginia, which had polled 92% against John Kennedy because he was Catholic, switched and actually supported him after that speech. He won West Virginia. As a matter of fact, it was not until after the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s that the Protestant world felt more at ease about what they viewed as the political philosophy of the Vatican. John Adams probably summed up the general opinion of his time in a letter he wrote to his wife Abigail, 1774. He had gone to a mass, and he said, quote, "It was most awful and affecting, the poor wretches fingering their beads, chanting Latin, not a word of which they understood, their paternosters and their Ave Marias, their holy water, their crossing themselves perpetually, their bowing and kneeling and genuflecting before the altar." Unquote. The memory of past persecutions is still a powerful force. A book, John Fox's Book of Martyrs, recounting the persecution of Protestants in gory detail, was widely read throughout the colonies. Many families had only two books, the Bible and the Book of Martyrs. The martyrs in this book number less than 400, quite a bit less than the 72,000 Catholics martyred by the end of Elizabeth's reign, and how many less than the millions of Irishmen martyred because they were Catholics over the next few centuries by the British Crown and by the British Church, since it was one thing. Educated Catholics honored Englishmen like Thomas More, John Fisher, Edmund Campion, the Carthusian monks, and the simple lay folk who went to their death rather than accept Henry VIII or Elizabeth as head of the church as a pope. As a consequence, in the colonies, both Protestants and Catholics were inclined to look upon each other as potential tyrants whose recent forebears had murdered saints and scoffed at the true gospel. Even after the Revolution, only four of the original states allowed Roman Catholics full equality with other Christians: Pennsylvania, with its long history of Quaker toleration; Delaware, Virginia, and Maryland. The constitutions of the other nine established one or more of the other Protestant sects, or Protestantism in general, as a state religion, and provided that anyone who held public office accept the truth of the Protestant faith. South Carolina did not lift the laws against Catholics until 1790. Georgia held out till 1798, New York until 1806, Connecticut until 1818, Massachusetts until 1833, North Carolina until 1835. There was a little jingle: "If Gallic papists have a right to worship their own way, then farewell to liberty of poor America." Now, there's no record of any Catholic attempt to subvert democratic liberties. As members of a persecuted minority, their leaders had reason to appreciate the benefits of religious tolerance. Perhaps for that reason, more than any other, they practiced tolerance somewhat better than the others. It was a natural turn of events that the first colony to establish a measure of religious toleration was founded by men who were papists, who accepted papal authority as a religious principle. American Catholic history, except for the French and Spanish territories, begins with the founding of Maryland. There begins the history of religious liberty in the United States, in Catholic Maryland. But even there, the wisdom of its founders was soon undone.
The Maryland experiment with religious toleration later became a source of pride to American Catholics.
The colony was originally planned by Sir George Calvert, a wealthy Yorkshireman who was a Catholic convert at the age of 44. After he converted, Calvert had to resign his office as Secretary of State, but he remained in favor with King James I, and he was named the first Lord Baltimore. 2 years before his conversion, Calvert had sponsored a short-lived colony in Newfoundland. As Lord Baltimore, he visited it in 1627. Disappointed with what he found, he set sail for the south in search of a more hospitable climate. In Virginia, the authorities insisted he take the oath of succession with its anti-Catholic provisions. He refused. He had taken note of the Chesapeake Bay region, which promised to support a body of transplanted English gentlemen comfortably and provide him with a tidy income. So he applied for a charter to establish a colony called Maryland, after the Mother of Christ. Although publicly he said it was after the reigning Queen Henrietta Maria. The deed, along with the title of Baron, was inherited by his son Cecil. The second Lord Baltimore was as shrewd a businessman as his father. Cecil Calvert set up a feudal barony in the new colony. A small group of Roman Catholic gentlemen and about 200 working men, some of them Protestants, set sail in 1633 and landed at St. Clement's Island. The group included two priests and one lay brother, all Jesuits, who did not come as official chaplains, but traveled at their own expense as gentlemen. As such, they were entitled to share in the division of the land.
The colony was carried on in this tolerant spirit until civil war broke out in England, and the king was deposed. The Puritans took power. In 1645, Claiborne, a powerful Virginian Puritan, led an invasion of the colony and took over the property of its Catholics. They held Maryland for 2 years, when they were finally driven back out by a Catholic force led by Leonard Calvert. During the occupation, two of the five Jesuits then in the colony, Fathers Andrew White and Thomas Copley, were arrested and sent back to England in chains. It was sending them to a certain death, for they were promptly arrested for violating the law forbidding priests to set foot in England under pain of death. They argued successfully that they had not returned to England willingly, but had been brought back in chains.
So they were spared.
The three remaining Maryland Jesuits had to flee to Virginia. All three died in exile, leaving the colony without priests, until Calvert pleaded with the Jesuit superior in England to send priests to replace those who had gone. The next year, the Maryland Religious Toleration Act was enacted into law. It formalized what had been practiced from the beginning, provided that no one was to be molested for his religion who professed to believe in Jesus Christ.
But things were about to be turned back around again. And we'll see what happens after the break. This is Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin
on BreadboxMedia.com.
Nice to get back together again. This is Setting Records Straight, Chuck Coughlin. We were just talking about the Catholic influence on the new British colony of Maryland in the New World. We were just considering how exceptionally tolerant they were compared to the other colonies of those with religious differences. But that was about to change. The Catholics were about to lose their political control of the colony to the Puritans all over again.
In a Puritan plot, a man named John Cook took over the colony again. The anti-Catholic laws were immediately put back in force. Maryland Catholics were angered by the setback, yet with nowhere to go, they remained where they were. Catholics were then denied the right to vote and the right to hold political office.
and also obliged to tithe to support the established Anglican Church. The leading Catholic families carried on somewhat undisturbed. A number of them grew rich in time and freely sent their sons to Catholic colleges in France, though it was actually against the law to do so. Among the young men who went abroad were two leading Catholics of their time, who later became very significant. One was Charles Carroll, who exercised more direct influence on the American Catholic community than any layman before or since, and his distant cousin John Carroll,
who later became the American Catholic Church's first bishop. The Carrolls had long been the first Catholic family of the colony. They were eminently acceptable. The founder of the American branch of the family was an earlier Charles Carroll, who arrived in Maryland in 1688, with a writ signed by the third Lord Baltimore appointing him Attorney General. The sons of Charles Carroll in turn increased the family's holdings. By the third generation, Charles Carroll III of Carrollton, as the first Charles' grandson chose to be known, was probably the richest man in America. Their homes, along with the Jesuit manors in the colony, were used for celebrations of the Mass and religious instruction. When, as happened from time to time, Catholic colonists were charged with plotting against the crown, it was taken for granted that a Carroll would answer the accusation.
A few years later, the governor of Maryland, writing about Carroll, naturally referred to him as head of the sect, meaning the Roman Catholic Church.
Though Carroll was a layman, actually the ecclesiastical superior of the Maryland Catholics, was an English bishop who had delegated his authority to the Maryland Jesuits. Now this Charles Carroll's son and namesake was to be the most distinguished member of the family. He and his cousin John, the future bishop, were friends and classmates, as they had been earlier at Bohemia Manor, the little school American Jesuits conducted in Maryland. After being educated, Charles returned to the colony to settle into the traditional life. John, who left America at the age of 13, didn't return until he was past 40. He had joined the Jesuits and been ordained a priest. Father Carroll returned to Maryland to live quietly in his mother's home at Rock Creek. His most productive years were still to come. Charles Carroll was born to be the leading Catholic layman of the day. Like most of the founding fathers, he was a man of conservative temper, in addition to being very wealthy. Through Charles Carroll, the Catholics of Maryland, probably around 1/12 of the colonists at the time, achieved their first solid social and even political acceptance. The crude anti-Catholicism that had gone unchallenged for so long became at least temporarily passé. Carroll was sent to the Second Continental Congress, where on his first day in office he signed the Declaration of Independence.
He was the only Catholic to sign the Declaration of Independence,
joining 12 Congregationalists, 29 Episcopalians, 8 Presbyterians, and 3 Unitarians, a Baptist, a Quaker, and Benjamin Franklin, who styled himself simply as a deist. Carroll not only supported the revolution with his private fortune, but put his tested diplomatic skills
in the service of the new nation.
He was elected to the U.S. Senate.
Later gave up the seat in order to have full time for the Maryland legislature,
which he regarded as a more important post. He lived to be 95, the last of the signers alive, living long enough to see the land of his birth change from a place where men of his religious convictions were deprived of ordinary civil rights
to a new nation where the practice of any faith or none was protected from interference by the government.
Now, his cousin John Carroll played a smaller part in the revolutionary cause. He was destined for a more formative role. He was America's first Catholic bishop, at least since the Vikings in the year 1100, and it fell to him to organize the American church, shape its character, and set the style that would later distinguish it as at once devoted to the papacy and still loyally American. John Carroll, as a priest, was always careful to not involve himself in political activities. "I have observed," he said, "that when the ministers of religion leave the duties of their profession to take a busy part in political matters, they generally fall into contempt
and sometimes even bring discredit to the cause
in whose service they are engaged." John was invited by the Continental Congress to join a diplomatic mission to Canada.
The purpose of it was to win Catholic support for the colonists' cause.
Certainly a bold undertaking. He was added to a committee that included Samuel Chase, a Maryland Protestant,
and was headed by no less than the suave Benjamin Franklin, whose gift for diplomacy was becoming legendary. Well, the committee never really stood a chance with the Canadian Catholics, who were still smarting from the Americans' recent show of disdain for their religious rights as Catholics. Franklin, who was suffering poor health at the time, was particularly distressed by the cold shoulder they were given upon their visit. It was a fiasco. The trip yielded one lasting effect, however. Father Carroll had been highly solicitous for the older man's comfort throughout the trip, and he and Franklin became lasting friends. Franklin said the priest had actually saved his life. 8 years later, when Franklin was in Paris, he was sounded out by the Vatican about how he felt about the appointment of Carroll to be the leader of the Catholic Church in America. He gave him an unqualified commendation. On Franklin's recommendation, Father John Carroll was appointed superior of the Catholic clergy in America. With many of the powers of a bishop, it may seem strange that he was not made a bishop, but in the beginning, the priests themselves were opposed to the idea of naming an American bishop. They argued that were convinced that naming a bishop would be more detrimental than otherwise to the interests of religion. All prelates of whatever Christian sects were hated figures in the colonies, and the members of the Catholic clergy were quite aware of the fact. Even the Anglicans had long avoided naming a bishop for the colonies. When eventually they did name a bishop, to no one's surprise, John Carroll was chosen. He was named Bishop of Baltimore, a diocese which then took in the entire territory of the United States. In his report to Rome, Carroll described the extent of Catholicism in the States. There were, he wrote, about 15,800 Catholics in Maryland, about 3,000 of them Negro slaves. Another 7,000 Catholics resided in Pennsylvania, 200 in Virginia, and perhaps 1,500 in New York. The Marylanders were comparatively well served by the ex-Jesuits,
who were quite aged but still able to work.
The Pennsylvanians were only visited by a priest 4 or 5 times a year. There are no priests in New York. More priests were needed immediately. Because Carroll was looked upon as an obscure bishop in an unimportant missionary outpost, neither his actions nor his ideas or requests were taken very seriously in the Vatican, which at the time was extremely preoccupied with the effects of the French Revolution on the church in Europe. Carroll himself undoubtedly underestimated his own importance, both as an American and as an ecclesiastic. When we look back on it now, he must be counted among the greatest of post-Reformation Roman Catholic bishops. He was neither a zealot nor a church reformer, but he understood the virtues of tolerance and the wisdom in governments making no claim to competence in theological matters. His sympathy for the new type of government found in the United States was apparent to all. It was a measure of Carroll's success as bishop in lessening the suspicion of a Catholicism that when St. Peter's, the first Catholic church in New York, was dedicated in 1786, President Washington and his cabinet, along with members of Congress, attended. A public dinner was held to mark the occasion. Historians view John Carroll
as one of those to whom we are most indebted for our religious freedom in this country.
He was later elevated to Archbishop of Baltimore. At Carroll's request, the original Diocese of Baltimore was elevated to an archdiocese with 4 suffragan sees in 1808. In addition to Carroll's own auxiliary, bishops were named for New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and Bardstown, Kentucky.
The Bardstown Diocese covered a vast territory, but the number of Catholics to be served was small.
There were French Catholics in the Kentucky Territory before it was admitted to the Union in 1792.
But they had gone without a priest for so long that they were only Catholic in name.
But by the time the Diocese of Bardstown was set up, their number had increased to about 10,000. Carroll brought a group of Carmelite nuns from Europe and sponsored the establishment of several of the convents, a number of academies and schools, the most important of which were Mount St. Mary, still in existence, and Georgetown, the present Jesuit University in Washington, D.C. All of this was done, of course, without state subsidy or significant grants.
The bricks and mortar bishops of later Catholicism in the United States were yet to come.
But it was Carroll who set the mold for them.
By the time of his death, there were 100 Catholic parishes in the land he served. By as many priests, the penal laws against Catholics were gone, never to return. Almost all pontifical offices and appointments were constitutionally open to members of the once despised church, even though it would be 145 years before a Roman Catholic would sit in the White House in the Oval Office.
We'll break now. This is Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin. This is Setting the Record Straight. On BreadboxMedia.com. Join me now to reflect upon the magnificent history of our beloved Catholic Church. I'm back with you on Setting the Record Straight. I'm Chuck Coughlin. We were considering the Carroll family in colonial Maryland, how they were important foundational people in the forming of the United States. The first American bishop and archbishop was John Carroll. We had just listed a small part of his achievements.
When he died, he left two serious problems as yet unsolved. One involved nationalistic rivalries among Americans from Ireland, Germany, and France, which soon threatened Catholic unity. The other was a system of lay trusteeship he allowed to get foothold in parishes under his direction. He wasn't a superman or even a super bishop, but his record as the original builder of the Catholic Church in America has yet to be outshone by any of the hundreds of Americans who had followed him in the Catholic hierarchy. He was not particularly charismatic or even conspicuously pious. However, it is extremely clear 200 years later that he was the right man in the right place at the right time.
So there you have it. There were two Catholics among the important founders of this country. One was Charles Carroll, signer of the Declaration of Independence and U.S. Senator, and the other, John Carroll, the first Catholic Archbishop of Baltimore, a diocese which included all 13 of the 13 states of the new United States of America. In 1973, John Coakley published a book entitled Catholic America. I want to credit this book as a source for much of this material. It's dedicated to the memory of a friend, John Courtney Murray, Society of Jesus. In the dedication, he quotes John Courtney Murray, who wrote this: "The Catholic may not, as others do, merge his religious and patriotic faith, or submerge one to the other. He must reckon with his own tradition of thought, which is wider and deeper than any that America has elaborated." Well, most mainstream histories leave out a greater presence of Catholics in greater numbers, preceding this and through this period. To set the record straight, I want to give a complete picture. These were Catholic slaves in British colonies, slaves of the British. And of course, there were a great many Catholics among the Indians that had been converted by the French up around the Great Lakes. And there were large numbers of Catholics on the West Coast among the Indians. But our considerations in this program are about the British colonies. And in these East Coast British colonies, there were Irish slaves. In 1641, Ireland's population was 1,466,000. 11 years later, there were only 616,000 Irish in Ireland. What happened? That means 850,000 Irish Catholics disappeared. That's over half. 850,000 were gone. 616,000 remained in Ireland. How did this happen? According to Sir William Petty,
850,000 were wasted by the sword, plague, famine, hardship, and banishment during and after the Confederation War of 1641. At the end of the war, vast numbers of Irish men, women, and children were forcibly transported to the American colonies by the English government. And as the historian Pendergast reports in 1742, quote, "In clearing the ground for the adventurers and soldiers, that is, the English capitalists of that period, to be transported to Barbados and the English plantations in America, it was a measure beneficial to Ireland, which was thus relieved of a population that might trouble the planters. It was a benefit to the people removed, which might thus be made English and Christians. A great benefit to West India sugar planters, who desired men and boys for their bondsmen, girls to solace them." An English law of 1657 says this: those who failed to transplant themselves into Connacht or County Clare, these are western provinces, within 6 months shall be attained of high treason, are to be sent into America. Those thus banished who return are to suffer the pains of death as felons by virtue of this act, without benefit of clergy. It is estimated that 100,000 young children who were orphans or had been taken for their Catholic parents were sent abroad into slavery into Virginia and New England, that they might lose their faith and all knowledge of their nationality, for in most instances even their names were changed. Moreover, the contemporary writers assert between 20,000 and 30,000 American men and women who were taken prisoner were sold in American colonies as slaves, with no respect to their former station in life. A historian declares that it is impossible to say how many shiploads of unhappy Irish were dispatched to America by the English government, and no mention of such shipments would be very likely to appear in state papers, but they must have been very considerable in number. The reason for this uncharacteristic absence of documentation is actually very simple. The British were very careful and went to elaborate precautions to cover their tracks. But we do have very reliable estimates. Estimates vary between 80,000 and 130,000 regarding the amounts of Irish sent into slavery during 9 years beginning in 1651. And this is most astounding. The number of Irish transported into the British colonies in America in these 9 years exceeded the total number of the inhabitants of those colonies during that period. What we're saying is that the population at the beginning of its 9 years of the American colonies was a certain number, and a greater number than that was brought in that 9 years as Irish Catholic slaves. We have to realize there's no way to know the exact number for certain. There are no good records. But we do know the amount was massive, even though the figures I've given are estimates. They are estimates from eminent historians. The flow of the Irish to American colonies throughout the remainder of the 17th century was large and continuous, but not nearly as massive as in those original 9 years. Some of the many statements by historians give evidence of this Irish tide. A historian named Dunn reports that with so many Irish Catholic servants and farmers, the English planters became obsessed with the fear of popery. Now, many of us have heard that these were indentured servants, people who were to be kept for a period of 5 years. But in truth, that was only on paper. They were slaves, as fully slaves as the unfortunate Africans who followed them. But during the 17th century, the importation of slaves into the British colonies that became the United States had a majority of white Irish Catholics. I mentioned earlier that the British deliberately covered their tracks. Let me tell you about the elaborate game that was played. A historian named Emmett explained this rather well in documented detail. I'll quote him: that the early and continued immigration of the Irish to this country during the 17th century has been lost sight of in consequence of this change to English surnames and from the fact that no vessel was knowingly allowed to sail from Ireland direct, but by law was obliged first to visit an English port before clearance papers could be obtained. Consequently, every Irish slave crossing in an English vessel or Irish vessel from either England or Ireland appeared in the official records as English, for the voyage did not begin, according to law,
until the ship cleared from an English port, and all passage on arrival in this country, in the American colonies, were listed in the documents as English. We may wonder why these Irish slaves didn't appear in the population statistics. A hint of what happened may come from what we know about the Irish slaves in the West Indies. One historian confirmed that most of the population lists for Barbados, Jamaica, and the Leeward Islands concern only parish registers of the Church of England. All other people were essentially ignored in the headcount. The English government variously referred to Irish to be transported as rogues, vagabonds, rebels, neutrals, felons, military prisoners, teachers, priests, maidens, etc. All historians seem to be in agreement that whatever you call these people, they were political victims. The plain facts are that most were treated as slaves. After their land was confiscated by England, which drove them from their ancestral home to forage for roots like animals, they were kidnapped, round up, and driven like cattle to waiting ships and transported to English colonies in America, never to see their country again. They were the victims of what many call the immense Irish slave trade. This is such a large subject that I'm devoting another program in Setting the Record Straight entirely to this issue. There's a number of books on the subject, and there's a great deal to cover. It's sad to report that all writers on this issue in the 17th century American colonies agree that the treatment of the white slaves in the English colony was cruel to the extreme, worse than that of the black slaves. I'm returning to this in another program, which you can avoid if you like, and I certainly understand it. All of this is very hard to bear. It's hard to bear thinking about this, but it's a part of our history, and it's better that we know it, to help us understand. Understand, if nothing else, the immense value, the preciousness of our Catholic faith. Why don't we go to every day to receive the Eucharist? The primary reason these Irish people were persecuted is that they were Catholics, faithful Catholics. We have to stand in awe of them, and we have to understand what they understood about the immense value of the Catholic faith. The very least these people deserve is for someone to tell their story and for us to pray for them. For Real Life Radio and RealLifeRadio.com, this is Chuck Coughlin, and this has been Setting the Record Straight.